Hello and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Scott Keith. I am again at the NALC convocation, the North American Lutheran Church convocation. I'm sitting here again with Dr. Jim Nestigan. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how are you doing, Scott?
As promised, we're doing sort of episode two of the one we started, which would have, for you guys, aired last Friday, where Jim did Old Man Luther for us. And he promised he'd come back. We're going to do a little short episode, maybe a Wednesday drop on the friendship between Luther and Melanchthon. Now, we also have sitting with us again today is Pastor Kevin McLean. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how's it going?
Thanks for being on Thinking Fellows again, episode two.
My pleasure.
The only requirement is that you share the episode on Facey Page.
Okay.
All right. We also have John Hoyam. Hi, John.
Hey, good to be with you guys.
I knew John a long time ago. I taught a single week class on Philip Melanchthon and the Loci Communes at Trinity Lutheran College in Everett, Washington. And John was a student there. And since that time, you went on to Luther Seminary.
Yep.
Studied under Steve Paulson. I think Jim knows Steve Paulson a little bit, right, Jim?
I do.
And just finished with your MDiv, right?
Yeah, going to be finishing up this next year. So I'll be on Vicarage in California.
Okay, well, you have a great radio voice, I have to tell you.
I've been told that,
It's very good.
I'm waiting for NPR to call.
You should get into this game here.
I just have a face for radio. Yeah. It's no good.
I think that's called TV, Kevin. Okay.
Okay, good.
All right, Jim. So for a long time, Jim and I worked together on a project that was my PhD dissertation.
You bet.
That had a lot to do with Philip Melanchthon, specifically on issues of the law and good works. But I thought a fun conversation would be for you and I to talk about sort of the friendship relationship between Luther and Melanchthon.
It's one of the most unusual friendships in church history.
Why is that? Why would you say that?
It's because there was a deep and abiding affection, particularly from Luther's side. He was a little bit older. Melanchthon came to Wittenberg in 1518.
Yeah, 1518-19 school year.
He was early arrival. He came as a young Latin professor. He was, 21, 22?
Also 1497, so 22.
22.
Yeah.
So he's just starting out teaching. He was single when he got there.
Yep.
And so he was with Luther on, he was with Luther on all the important occasions early in the Reformation.
That's right.
So Luther was absolutely smitten with him, and particularly, what was impressive to Luther was his amazing gift with languages. He was a linguist's linguist.
Right, he came to Wittenberg to teach languages, not to teach theology. It's almost a matter of Luther's influence altogether that he ended up teaching theology and becoming interested in the theology and Luther's theology and the theology of what we would now call the Reformation.
Yeah, and in fact, though he was, you know, one of the old saws, one of the old comparisons is that Luther was the prophet of the Reformation and Melanchthon the scribe.
Right.
Melanchthon was the systematician of the Reformation. Luther always remained a biblical theologian. He was an occasional theologian, which means he did theology occasionally, but it meant that he always was addressing a specific circumstance or occasion.
Right.
Melanchthon was much more programmatic.
Yeah, and you could even see that in something like the difference between the catechism and, say, the Loci Communes, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The catechisms were written to an occasion, 1527. You know, they're addressing the lack of education in the pastorate, and they're trying to provide resources to those pastors so that right doctrine and teaching and biblical teaching can be taught well. And so the catechisms come out as a result of that, whereas the Loci Communes is really written because of Melanchthon's lectures first, that he then is unhappy with how well they're presented when it's first published, and so he takes about over the course of 40 some odd years to rewrite them and systematize them and rewrite them and systematize them and rewrite them and systematize yeah. them to make them as quote-unquote clear as possible.
Right. He wrote one book and he wrote it all his life.
He did, yeah. Same thing with One Confession, right?
Yeah, exactly. I love it. That it's so interesting. When people, my old teacher Warren Quenbeck used to say that when people look at their handwriting, they almost invariably mistake Luther's handwriting for Melanchthon's, and vice versa.
Oh, really?
Melanchthon had a big, sprawling hand. He wrote in large and somewhat ungainly letters, huh?
Huh.
Whereas Luther's writing is very small and precise.
Right.
And he would be a penmanship teacher's dream,
huh.
because he is so careful.
That's interesting.
And, their personalities were different. Luther was the sprawler. He was the one that lived wide open, and Melanchthon was quite a bit more disciplined and precise.
Well, yeah, that even comes out in Luther's comment about the difference between he and Melanchthon. I mean, I'll paraphrase it, but basically he says, I'm rough and boisterous. My job is to tear up thorns and thistles and destroy fields, and Master Melanchthon comes behind me tidying everything up and making it into a nice road that people can travel.
I love those comparisons. Once he said, I am a broad X. Philip is a plane.
Yeah.
So a broad X, if you've ever seen one, is, I've got a 12-inch edge on it, and it's for flattening the side of a beam. A plane can be much smaller. The good one is 14 inches long and slides over and takes a very thin ribbon out of the wood. So it's a wonderful comparison, because Luther was big and rough and sprawling. Another time he said, I am Isaiah and Philip is Jeremiah. Isaiah uproots and destroys everything along its way, and Master Philip comes along behind like Jeremiah, and he gripes and complains and snips. Lots of fun.
So Melanchthon gets to Wittenberg 1518, 1519 school year. Luther and they kind of hit it off. Melanchthon's a hard worker. Luther is too. He can often be found, falling asleep in the library to candlelight as he's studying, sleeping on the ground. He's a sickly character, as I think especially as Luther observes. And Luther eventually encourages him to get married, right?
Right. That's a famous story.
Yeah.
The fun part of it is that Catherine von Bora did not like Philip's wife.
Did not like Catherine von Krapp.
Yeah. She was, Catherine von Bora was like Luther. I mean, she was expansive.
Yeah.
And the other Catherine was somewhat hidden.
More high-minded.
Yeah, more high-minded.
See, so Luther is worried, essentially, about Melanchthon's health and encourages him to get married. Melanchthon does not want to get married. He sees himself as a confirmed lifelong bachelor and, following in the footsteps of his heroes like his great uncle Reuchlin and Erasmus and the other great humanists. He doesn't really see himself getting married. He's I'll spend too much time in the library to get married and take care of a family. And Luther's worried about him
because
doesn't eat, he doesn't sleep, he doesn't wash his clothes, he's stinky, and so Luther kind of sets up this marriage and ends up marrying him off to the mayor of Wittenberg at the time.
Yeah.
The marriage, and I think it's not as celebrated, but it goes famously well for them too.
Yeah, except in Catherine von Bora's mind, the other Catherine was not a very good housekeeper.
Oh, yeah.
And she complained voluminously about Catherine's inability to manage money and to manage the household. In fact, once Catherine von Bora hired a servant for them so that servant could go over and clean house.
Sounds like an overbearing mother-in-law, just a little bit.
You could say that, I think.
Yeah.
lots of fun.
So did there were there any disagreements between the two in their lifetime?
Oh, this is the two things. First of all, in the eyes of scholars, there most certainly were disagreements. But measuring those disagreements is one of the most difficult aspects of Luther research and Melanchthon research.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, they're so close and they're so consciously, so self-consciously close that just where you think you find a difference, it closes.
Yeah.
And secondly, it appears to me, after working with this question for a long, long time, that Luther took his own explanation of the Eighth Commandment
very seriously.
Very seriously.
Right.
He interpreted their differences in the kindest light.
Right.
And even where others see profound differences, Luther will say things like this: I can't believe that. I can't believe that Master Philip has gone so deep into these fantasies.
Right.
You know. So here's Luther writing one of his greatest volumes, you know, on the bondage of the will. Melanchthon was offended and particularly by the conflict with Erasmus.
So, right.
He worried about that. But on the other hand, well, he complains in his funeral discourse. When he preached for Luther's funeral, he complains of Luther's stoic Manichaean deliria concerning the will.
Yeah.
Huh?
But
on the other hand, he's practicing astrology.
I know.
And he's
I know.
He won't believe in it theologically, but he's an astrologer who's studying his own charts every day.
He's an interesting person to try to nail down, and I mean, perhaps we're not able to. You know, he's complex, just like every person that's ever lived. I would say, though, that I think it's somewhat easier to find mild criticisms of Luther coming from Melanchthon than of Melanchthon coming from Luther. I mean, you bring up while Luther's writing The Bondage of the Will. And drafts are coming out. Melanchthon is writing letters complaining. My sense is not so much of the fact that Luther's writing against Erasmus, but the names that he's calling Erasmus as he's doing it.
Right.
He feels like he's treating this great scholar uncivilly, and it bothers him.
I think probably Melanchthon could have won that argument, though.
Yeah, I think he probably could have. Yeah.
I mean, in the funeral oration, he complains, too, of Luther's harsh language, which he found unbearable. And, of course, I mean, that was a difference between them. I mean, Luther was a peasant, the son of a miner, up-and-coming miner. His mother was quite a bit more refined than his father, but Melanchthon really came from, you know, he was from thoroughbreds. He was
he grew up in the courts.
Yeah, he was a real, much more disciplined. And so when Luther is describing shit and silver dishes, Melanchthon just, what?
Yeah,
he can't take it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, so Melanchthon outlives Luther by, you know, many years. So Luther dies in 1546.
Right.
The only person, and you said it yesterday, that I'm aware of that's present as far as Luther's friends at his death is Eustace Jonas.
Yep.
I mean, what impact did that have on Melanchthon that you've read? I mean, in my readings of Melanchthon, it was a devastating blow.
Oh, it was. He said, gone is the horseman of Israel.
Yeah.
I mean, he compared Luther to Elijah, which was, you know, that may sound real inflated and off the charts these days, but at that time that was it was considered an apt comparison.
Right.
Because Luther had, you know, was known to have had such a major impact on the church and the culture.
Yeah.
So, and he, I mean, he, it, it, you know, I think it's safe to say that Melanchthon had something of a depressive personality.
I think that's safe to say.
Yeah, when he met challenges like this, his tendency was to withdraw and to.
Yeah.
He came out and preached at the funeral, of course, but he it was a real turning point for him, and he had a terrible time kind of coming to terms with.
Yeah, and coming back from it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and of course, not long after that, you have the Smalcaldic Wars, and the Augsburg and the Leipzig interims come after that, and that's a for as much as criticism as somebody could level at Melanchthon for his participation in the interims. That was not a fun time for him.
No.
I mean, I think you could not describe that as anything other than miserable.
And he was blessed with the animosity of one of the most hostile polemicists in the history of the Lutheran Reformation, Matthias Flacius Illyricus.
Yeah.
A great Croatian theologian who just, you know.
Was relentless.
Relentless, who saw the truth with alarming clarity and went for Melanchthon's gonads every chance he got.
That's right.
You know.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, they move on from that, and it's, I mean, Melanchthon's story after that is kind of interesting, I think. You know, in the late 1540s, he's involved with the interims to a higher degree than he probably should have been.
Yeah.
Although I always like to say in his defense, I believe he thought he was saving lives.
Oh, I don't think there's much doubt about that.
In so doing.
Yeah.
You know, what a decision to have to make. I like to ask people, you know, how would you like to be put in those shoes where it's make some concessions here on this theological point, or your friends stay in prison, your friends die.
It's easy to want to look at things from a purely academic standpoint or from a purely relational standpoint, but you think those two things happen simultaneously. For Melanchthon, the death of Luther understood, and it's written down that he understood when he dies that it was going to bring about a time of great difficulty. And for Melanchthon, as the heir apparent, knowing that you're not going to fill those shoes, you're not going to be the guy that Luther was.
Yet
you're going to be asked to be that guy.
Yes, you're being looked to be that guy.
All while you're suffering
the
loss of somebody who you loved.
And the seeming loss of the Reformation, to be honest with you.
Yeah, exactly. That's true.
Yeah, and all the work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of interesting. By their work, by all rights, the men sort of, I wouldn't say they had equal standing, but look, Melanchthon's the author of the Augsburg Confession. He's the author of the Apology. I mean, at this time, these churches are identifying as the churches of the Augsburg Confession, for Pete's sake.
Yep.
He's the author of the Lutheran systematic theology, even as it's revised, it's still used to teach pastors in the universities. And he is looked to, you know, and his friend has just died. He's crushed. The Reformation has seemingly died and it's crushed. He's making these concessions. He's constantly attacked. I do think his presentation at Luther's funeral is kind of interesting. Was it you that wrote the Erasmus at Luther's funeral, or was that somebody else?
No, it was somebody else.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an interesting article because it just brings out that at Luther's death, Melanchthon's humanism, I mean, just it's always been there, maybe moderated by Luther's influence a little bit, but at his death, his humanism just comes back, and it's just in full force.
Yeah, yeah.
And by that, we mean sort of his classical training and his reliance on classical figures and authors.
I was going to go back to your comment about, in contemporary life, the estimate of Luther and Melanchthon is exactly reversed.
Oh.
When we look at the Reformation, we think of Luther.
Yeah.
And when we look at this period, you know, Luther commands, English-speaking, German-speaking scholarship across the boards. In the 16th century, Melanchthon was a more prominent figure.
Yeah, there was published to a degree and used, I guess I'd say.
Right, and consulted. And brought into the discussion. He was, from 1529 forward, Luther was regarded as a kind of a crackpot,
yeah,
a sick old man, and in lots of ways he was. You know, right. He produced some of his best stuff, but he did some of the most stupid stuff during that time. And so, but Melanchthon was healthy and he was working and he was, you know, he was in consultation. So he was in lots of ways more prominent and more respected, I think.
Well, and he was, as Bob Cole points out, from mid-1520s on, Melanchthon is the one that is sent all over the place in order to be the ambassador on behalf of the evangelical reforms.
Yep, he's the diplomat.
He is sent everywhere. And I like to point out, too, that we think of Luther as so stalwart, right? And again, from Bob Kolb, he says that, well, Luther had the advantage of being able to stay in Wittenberg and throw rocks at the Pope from Wittenberg. Whereas Melanchthon had the somewhat disadvantage of being told by his elector, go here, make concessions. Go here, make concessions. Exactly. Go there, make concessions.
Yeah. That's important. That's real important.
And then he's seen as a conciliarist after that. And I think, would you say no to the prince?
No, he was in a position where he was required to do what he did.
Yeah.
You know, the romanticism has done damage to both sides. I mean, Flaccius becomes the great hero, you know. He was a jerk.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I like him theologically, but he was just nuts.
Right.
And the same, and Melanchthon and Luther, the romantic picture of Luther that we get in the statues and in the, you know, the 19th century view of him, I mean, is way out of keeping with what was actually going on in the 16th century.
Right.
So it's you know, the closer you get and the more you see, the larger Melanchthon's influence and the larger his contribution looms, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's he's writing in every subject too, right? So people know him. He's reforming universities. He's writing in mathematics and history and philosophy and classics and languages and theology and astrology. I mean, he's you write that much and you publish that much and your works are used as resources and curriculum, and you're just a well-known guy.
Yeah, just think of this. He reformed the university curriculum, and that remained the university curriculum until into the 19th century.
Right.
I mean, that's, if it was only that.
Yep.
It would be a phenomenal achievement.
So just finishing this up, I always like to, because I know you've got things to do. You are a busy man at these things, and we thank you for your
cat on a hot tin roof
carving out some time to sit with us. And I have to get John to say at least one thing before we go. But
I'll try.
There you go. That's enough.
Check that.
What do you want to know? Ask me about Luther Seminary. How great it's going.
No, let's not do that. We'll ask you that next year.
Speaking of depressive personalities.
Oh boy.
So Melanchthon dies in 1560. You know, the year after the publication, the final publication of his great work, the Loci Communis Theologici. He dies and just sort of lending to this idea that he has a depressive character. He's depressed, especially after Luther's death. Where the Reformation goes after that is sort of a confusing thing to him. Where Lutheranism ends up, I think, is a confusing thing after the Smalcaldic Wars. We get some clarity, of course, with the writing of the Formula of Concord and the publication of the Book of Concord years later, you know, some decade and a half or more later. But on his death, and you brought up Flaccius, so I'll in on his death, he says to his son-in-law, who was a physician, he looks over at him and says, I know I go now the way of all men. Save me from the ravings of the theologians.
Yeah.
You know. And
yeah, he used another term occasionally, the rabies of the theologians.
Yeah. And
he had been bitten repeatedly.
Yep.
You know, when you mention the formula, it's Luther's student, it's Melanchthon's students.
Yes.
Who lay the groundwork for what we know as Lutheranism.
Right.
So, I mean, again, that's an illustration of his significance.
Yeah, that's right. We have the great Martin Chemnitz who lived in his home for a year.
Golly.
You know?
Yeah. The second Martin.
The second Martin. All right, so Jim, we have like 3 minutes left. How should we end this?
Shall we sing?
Well, I may listen.
Oh, no, it's fun. I suppose we could say a little bit about that title, the Loci Communicus, Loci Theologicus. It's theological commonplaces.
That's right.
Where, in effect, the commonplaces are the something like the theorems in geometry. They're the beginning of the calculations. So he's he writes the Loci out of the Book of Romans. It's organized on the basis of the Book of Paul's letter to the Romans. He sets up theological statements for further reflection that shape. Is that fair?
It is fair. Yeah.
That shape ongoing theological conversation.
When I did, well, you know this, but I'll tell the listeners. When I did my research, I came to understand that Melanchthon thought by way of the Loci Communis, not just the theological topics, but in his life, in his studies, in his academic work, he broke everything down and examined everything according to the method of the Loci.
Isn't that fun?
And it's an interesting thing to absorb, because the more you read him, especially in his Latin, you can see him doing it, and it doesn't matter the subject, it doesn't matter if it's a personal letter, he thinks by way of this method. And the listeners can go check it out over at 1517legacy.com under my name as a contributor. I translated one of the little pieces that Melanchthon wrote on the Loci, on the method of the Loci, and published it up there under the...
Huh, great, that's valuable.
Meeting Melanchthon series, and so people can get that for free there. And check it out. Jim, I want to thank you. I don't want to keep you late. I want to thank you for coming on. It's been a blessing to have a Luther scholar as my guiding mentor for Melanchthon studies.
Yeah, well, I'm so proud of the work you did. That thesis of yours is just a major achievement, and it's a great contribution, so I'm grateful to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I wish I'd had your languages, boy. You did a really fine job.
Thank you. Some of that translation is up on 1517, so people go check it up for free. All right, thanks, Jim.
Okay.
Thanks, John. Say one more thing.
See you guys.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin, for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Right. We importuned him, and he didn't importune.
All right. Bye-bye.
Hey there. This is producer Caleb, and I want to thank you for listening to this somewhat shorter episode of the Thinking Fellows podcast. I wasn't able to make it this time. I was out of town, but you'll get to hear me join Dr. Keith with Dr. Ness again on a handful of new episodes coming up in the next couple of weeks. Dr. Keith and I are traveling to a conference in Norway that Dr. Ness again will be speaking at, and there we'll join him. We'll be having a booth for the 1517 Legacy Project, selling some books and handing out flyers, but we'll also have some after conference time to record podcasts just like this. The series that we are currently in is part of a lead up to the Here We Still Stand conference. And what I want to do right now is remind everybody to get those tickets before it's too late. The conference is coming up here in mid-October, October 19th through the 21st. And in addition to the tickets to the conference, you're going to want to book your hotel room. We have a suite of rooms blocked out at the location which the conference is happening at. That is the Hyatt Regency Mission Bay Spa and Hotel in San Diego, California. We have a discounted rate at those rooms that we need to fill up in order to maintain that. And so when you're on the Here We Still Stand website and you register for the conference, there's also a section for logistics and the hotel. I'm going to put a direct link to the making a reservation under the 1517 Legacy block. That way, when you buy your tickets, you can get that hotel. Or if you've only bought your tickets and you've put off buying your stay for the conference, you can do that now. This is the prime location to be at. There's a lot included with the hotel stay here, and you can wake up in the morning, you know, grab a quick shower and just walk downstairs to the conference. So that makes things really easy. You can probably even get away with not having to rent a car or have to walk too far if you're coming in from a flight or something like that and you're not already in Southern California. So thank you for listening to this episode, and we'll catch you next time.